Test, test. This is Dave Crippen of the archives of the Edison Institute in Dearborn. And this is one of our design history interviews. And today we're in Vero Beach, Florida, a lovely sunny day on February 5th, 1985. And we are about to interview Mr. well-known automotive designer, Mr. Adrian Gill Spear. And we'll ask Mr. Spear to tell his story in his own narrative, as he has seen it over his lifetime.
Well, all right, Dave. I'm actually going to start, since you asked me to do it chronologically, about 4 years before I was born. My father was a fairly well-known commercial artist, and I'm looking at a Pierce Arrow poster that he did in 1910. He, along with some other prominent artists, mostly in New York, had been asked by Pierce Arrow to do a series of posters, apparently one or two each. At this time, he was had come out from New York City to head up the art department of the Peninsular Engraving Company in Detroit. In those days, I believe the printing companies did both the, will you excuse me? The printing companies had their own art departments, and they did not only the artwork for the client, but also conducted as advertising. And my father, being a prominent New York commercial artist, had been brought out from the big city to run this. And like a lot of New Yorkers, he couldn't stand being away from the big city and went back fairly soon. So I don't remember this, but
was he Gill Spear also?
He was Gill Spear, correct. Now, what I'm getting into here is the Norman Belgetti story, not so much my father. My dad didn't drive. He had had an automobile accident where he had skidded into the side of a streetcar, I think at Woodward and Outer Drive or someplace, and so he had a chauffeur. Like most New Yorkers, he didn't drive, and his attempt at it was not successful. But his chauffeur one day brought in a young lad who was Norman Geddes, and he had been giving this young man rides into the city. And the young man wanted to get into the artwork, into art business. So my dad gave him a job. Doing minor things in the studio, evidently. Norman, I understand, was somewhat enamored of my mother, who was probably quite a beautiful woman at that time, and he used to come and visit at the house and visit with her quite a bit. But he learned that my father had added the Gill to his name.
What had been his name earlier?
His name had been Adrian Spear, just plain Adrian Spear, and he didn't think that rhymed the best. He was also a very good writer, and so he added the Gill. I think that was the name of a well-known Spanish writer that he admired. So he put the Gill in, and that made it come out nicely, according to him. Norman later on married a woman whose first name was Belle, B-E-L-L-E, And he thought that was a good idea, so he He made a masculine name out of the bell, B-E-L, and stuck that in the middle of his name. And incidentally, he his wife was the daughter of one of the lumber kings who were, in those days, still stripping Michigan of its trees. And Norman then had access to not only printing, but plenty of paper, which was made from wood. So Norman got out a book, and he sent it to all the big people in the world that he could think of, and the book was titled What I Think by Norman Bel Geddes. That was used to influence people. He was a very bold man.
He published that himself.
He published that himself. I understand from my dad for quite a few years. Of course, at this time, I knew nothing about it. But later, I did work for Norman. Now, I don't know whether we should keep on a chronological trail here, or I'd have to skip a
Please.
Bit. Okay, I'll stay on Norman Bel Geddes for a bit. Norman hired me as a designer in 1938. At this time, he was a very well-known designer. In fact, I think the first industrial designer. And you may have seen some of his photographs of his streamlined boats and yachts and cars and cities and buildings. I have a fairly good sample of them here, but
forgive me, Gil. Yeah. Between the time that your father hired him and you, and he hired you, what did he do for your father at that time? What did he, was he hired as an illustrator?
He worked, I think, as a handyman in a studio. He's pretty young then.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But he got his start there.
Mm-hmm.
My dad complained that he always did very small work, that he didn't do big work. I think probably Norman then was more interested in design rather than illustration.
Mm-hmm.
But from that start, Norman went on to become a quite a well-known stage designer
mm-hmm.
in New York. And I know he and my dad were in touch quite a bit because my dad was doing posters for the Theater Guild and Norman was doing stage sets for them.
Do you remember what year your father may have hired him?
That would probably be 1910 to 1912.
Fine.
Some place in there.
Mm-hmm.
Norman brought this desire to attract attention with designs over into product styling, which actually didn't exist until he made it a vocation. But he had this tremendous flair for color and making things dramatic. That
very imaginative.
Yeah, it was very imaginative. When I went to work for him, he appreciated somebody who had been brought up somewhat the same way to try and be original and do things that would get some attention. At any rate, I'm really going after Norman Bel Geddes now.
Yes.
Norman died in 1958, so you can't interview him. He, someplace in the mid-30s, came up with the idea of gridding United States with limited access highways. Now, whether this was original with Norman or not, I don't know, but he's the one who pushed it. He prepared this terrific exhibit for the New York World's Fair, which opened in 1939, and apparently made an approach to one of the big rubber companies. It might have been U.S. U.S. Tire Company. They turned him down because it would be too expensive to do, and he, being a very bold person, went to General Motors and sold them on doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And this display that he did was the big attraction at the New York World's Fair in 1939. It drew all the crowds. We had people in line 8 persons wide and going completely around the block waiting to get in this all day, almost every day, for 2 years.
You remember the name of that exhibit?
It was the Futurama. And what it was, we had a walled-in intersection in a city. We had 4 buildings forming a cross intersection. The intersection had elevated sidewalks. This was supposed to be in the future. Mm-hmm. 1960, believe it or not. And the people were waiting to get in. Maybe you want, I don't know whether you want to shut that off or not. I wanted to show you some photographs that'll help me describe it. The people were waiting to get into a moving display. I really should read a description of it in here.
Please, please do.
Well, can you hold it again? Although it may take too long. People were waiting to get on a tracked. They had seats that were on a track, and they wound in and out around a scale model countryside, which I forget how many acres it was in size, but they were supposed to imagine they were flying in an airliner over the eastern half of the United States. And down below, they would see these scale interstate roads that had all the types of cloverleaf intersections and separations that we have today that we're so used to on our interstates. The track that these seats rode on had a soundtrack built into it, so that when you were at any one point, you were having what you were looking at described to you. You eventually, if you were riding on this thing, saw a city in the far distance, which actually was a rework of St. Louis, with many more skyscrapers and so forth. As you approached this city, you would be turned around, so you'd suddenly look at another display, and you'd be looking at the same city, only part of it, at a larger scale, as if your airplane were coming in for a landing and at a lower altitude. This was done several times, and you finally found yourself focusing on an intersection in the city with elevated sidewalks and so forth. At this time, while your ride again made an outside turn, and you got off, walked out, and here you were in this same intersection. It was a very dramatic presentation.
Did he use films to aid the visual?
No, not really at all. Mm-hmm. We subcontracted this part of the display to a contractor, and he hired or rented the old MGM studios up in Harlem, which William Randolph Hearst had built for really for Marion Davies. He had a fantastic apartment in the front for her, and the place had 2 huge studios in it. It was about 3 blocks wide, 3 short blocks wide, and 1 long block long at least. And it had, it must have had hundreds of rooms off of balconies. And we made little workrooms and offices out of these. And we set the primary display up on the floors of the 2 big studios. They were, I think, 36 feet long by 3 foot wide tables. And all of these were sections of the eventual model to be joined together. The 3 foot width was so that no person working would have to reach more than 18 inches. And I think we hired all the architectural students in the New York City area to not only work on this, but help plan it. And they all had to join the Model Makers Union, I can recall that. And then we shipped these by truck across the East River to the eventual site. But it was It was quite a thing, and after showing this for 2 years, Norman wrote a book called Highways and Horizons, describing how we would have parking troubles in the future and how there, when anybody built a building, they should be restricted to the building size because of the density of the of its population, or parking should be provided. He went into this at quite a length. His older daughter, not Barbara, the actress, was the editor of the book, and most of us contributed to it. I made diagrams of some of these things, how they should go and so forth. But Norman went down and presented the whole thing to, the whole scheme to President Roosevelt. And from there on, the thing grew. I believe Roosevelt finally got the ball rolling on an interstate highway system. Of course, he didn't live to see it start because he died before the war was over. But for the origination of the idea and how it was worked out, you'd have to see somebody who was with Norman before I was. I don't know if you're interested in that.
Oh, yes, very much.
I can...
incredible visionary.
Oh, yeah, he was really terrific. Yes. Very hard man to work for, but would you like me to read you some of the names into this, or...
Please, yes, go ahead.
Okay. You should look up in the New York area, Peter Schlatterman.
Schladermundt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After Norman quit the business, retired, I believe he sold that to Pete and to someone else, mm-hmm. and they ran it for 10 or 20 years. Now, whether Pete's still alive or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think he was up in the New Haven area, upriver from New York City.
Please read that paragraph there, if you will.
All right. For more on the origination of the 1939 Futurama highway system, which led to our present interstate system, look up Peter Schlatterman. In or near New York City, he became a partner with Bell Geddes and later took over the business. If he's not alive now, try to find Al Fordyce.
That's Fordyce.
A prominent architect of that area who was chief architect on the project. Later, in 1945, he was with Raymond Loewy.
Loewy.
I think that's, it may be a W-E-Y.
W-E-Y.
It's a well-known name. A man named Paxton, P-A-X-T-O-N, younger than Bell Geddes, was a partner, probably for financial reasons, in the late 30s. He would really be able to tell about it.
That's the Futurama.
Futurama, yeah. Otherwise, try to find L. Garth Huxtable, H-U-X-T-A-B-L-E, or I-B-L-E, a younger architect who worked for Bell Geddes, starting before I did. His wife, I believe, writes for architectural publications.
Most recently, the New York Times.
Oh, right. Is that
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Ada Huxtable, I think.
Well, I think she may be his wife. Mm-hmm. But he was a young man then and not in a too responsible a position, but he might be able to tell something about it. All these people would be in the New York area, I think. Do you mind if I go ahead?
Please, go ahead.
After the 39 World's Fair, we worked on a book Norman published. Its title was Highways and Horizons, explaining how traffic should be planned for the future. His other older daughter, not Barbara, the actress, put it together. She may have been designated as editor. Norman was invited to the White House and presented the highway scheme to President Roosevelt. Perhaps I should say sold it to him. This was before we got into the war.
So you're pretty much convinced that it was Bell Geddes who presented the idea of a interstate highway system in the most graphic form available and sold it to President Roosevelt?
I think by its popularity, mm-hmm. this display's popularity, it became quite a convincing story. The only thing I know that preceded this was the highway system that Hitler at that time was putting across Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I'm sure, had something to do with it.
But all we had in those days was the Pennsylvania Highway, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that didn't go all the way across Pennsylvania at that time either. But This is probably that, and the German Autobahns were what got Norman started on this thing. Well, so much for the Norman Bel Geddes story. When I was a youngster, I was aware that it was good to be original and to come up with new ideas that people would like. This influence came from my father and also from my stepmother, who was a commercial artist, but more towards the fashions rather than theater and things like that. And I think this probably had a lot to do with preparing me for design in the future. Also, after school, I used to go on a scooter down Fifth Avenue in New York. My father and stepmother had a commercial art studio on 42nd Street facing the north side of the New York Public Library, and I would spend time in the library, but I'd spend more time in their studio. Now, artists like this usually don't like to do lettering, and they don't like to fill in backgrounds. And so at an early age, they had me doing that, plus a lot of the dirty work that goes on in a commercial art studio. I also was loaned out to other artists, there were quite a few studios in that area, to pose. I was very often the little freckled boy on the front cover of American Boy magazine and things like that. It was before photography was used as much as it is today. So this got me into not only being original on purpose, but also into handling art tools and being able to draw and paint at an early age. I also went to a so-called progressive school in New York. It was the Walden School for Children.
W-A-L-D-E-N.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now this was a school that started at a low grade and progressed on up to up through high school as they added new grades, and then eventually up through college. And it may still be in existence in New York City, but I'm sure it's moved far away from where I went to school, which was on West 68th Street off Central Park. That school did not have formal lessons, so to speak. We more or less played, and the teachers would encourage us to get interested in things and carry on through. I spent most of my time either in the wood shop or the chemistry lab.
I think it was a progressive school.
That was what it was called. And this probably had quite a bit to do with having design ability later. I remember we would compete with one another to come up with new ideas on how to do things and so forth. That undoubtedly had something to do with it. And I also recall as a boy that I used to collect photographs and illustrations of cars and automobile magazines and cut them out and mount them in a book. So I must have had some interest in automobile design even at that early age. These mostly belong to an uncle of mine who lived in the Philadelphia area and who always had the latest hot automobile, and he was, I think, one of the first ones in Philadelphia to have a radio, and he was building in a shop in the middle of his house a thing that was terrific to me. It was a complete working scale model of a steam locomotive, all out of brass. He'd make the wheels out of wood and then take those to a casting company to have them cast in metal. And this thing looked to me as if it was about 10 feet long. It was probably more like 6 because I was a little boy then. But I think all those things undoubtedly had a big influence, you know, on a kid, on a, or rather on a kid's future. I don't know, maybe we can pause here a minute. While I'm on the subject of education, I later went to several different prep schools in the New Jersey, New England area. And looking back, I find those to be rather restrictive on the student who might have talent. Their education is very formal, and it's more or less by rote. But I went through this. Eventually, I went to high school in Great Neck, Long Island, where I graduated. By this time, we were in the midst of the Great Depression, and I no longer went to private schools. I was very much influenced there by my football coach, who was a very original man.
Remember his name?
Yeah, his name was Clifford H. Sears, known as Bucky.
S-E-A-R-S.
Yes, correct. Now, this may not look as if it has much to do with design, but I got to know him quite well, and he would come up with more original ideas on how to out-trick a superior foe on the football field. Everything was always very much that way, and he actually had a terrific record as a high school football coach in that area for a number of years. This helped a lot. Another thing that helped a lot was one of my best friends in that school system was the science teacher. I used to visit with him and do carpentry at his home, and got to know him quite well. But it gave me a big desire to know how things worked, which is important to the industrial and automotive designer, certainly. When I got out of high school, I went into the profession of digging sewer ditches, which I was lucky to have a job at $16 a week doing that. But one night my parents came home and announced I was going to meet a man who was an instructor at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, a man by the name of Goodyear, who taught commercial art there. They had met him at a party or something. And the next morning I found myself standing out on the north shore of Long Island in a fog, waiting for a strange man to pick me up and take me for an interview. Goodyear delivered me to man whose name was James Boudreau, B-O-U-D-R-E-A-U. Boudreau was head of art part of Pratt. And Pratt at that time had a very big reputation for advertising artists, architects, engineers. That is, it was very practical. These people would get jobs even when they were young.
Where was it located?
In Brooklyn, New York, on Ryerson Street, I believe. Boudreau saw my sketches, and that's all I had because I wasn't prepared for this. But I had a lot of football sketches, automobile sketches, and airplane sketches. I was a nut on aircraft and that type of thing. Boudreau had been a pilot in the Lafayette Escadrille in World War I for the French. And he had his own small airplane out at Roosevelt Field, and would take me flying there, but he was intrigued by a boy who could draw airplanes, and they were original airplanes mostly. So he proposed to me that I become a student of one in a new class which he'd call industrial design. And I, for a year, would go to classes. I took architectural courses. I took interior design courses. There were no courses for this subject.
Excuse me. What year was this that you were at Pratt?
I'll have to look that up. This would be 1932 to 1935. This was 1932.
32. Yeah. Now, 1932, there was no industrial design curriculum at Pratt.
No. No. People like Norman Bel Geddes and one or two others had been in the field for a few years. They had started it. And Boudreau was very anxious to get things going here. To him, it was architecture for general products, which of course is true. But for a year or so, I kept a separate notebook on my instructors and what I thought of what I was learning, and they kept notebooks on me. I also went out with Boudreau on lecture tours and helped him set up his easel and his sound systems, and he was at that time trying to push the idea that there was this new field that commercial people should get interested in, and also other schools. In fact, I would stand at the easel and make sketches for people to look at. These would be small groups of people, like the YMCA at a little dinner or something. And later I got so I could go out and give his lecture myself when he couldn't make it. He was a real nut for flying. His son's name was René Fonck Boudreau. René Fonck was one of the World War I French aces. But this got me into that type of thing. And of course, as a young man, you can be very influenced by people like this. I attended a lecture by, I'm trying to think of the architect's name, who did very modern things in those days. Can we turn that off for a minute? I attended a lecture by Frank Lloyd Wright at Pratt one day, and Wright wondered what all we students were doing, sitting around copying each other, and he advocated getting out and working in the industry. And much to Boudreau's disappointment, I had a scholarship by this time to go through school. I took that out by going to night school and went to work. Actually, my parents weren't doing very well. It was the Depression still, and they needed some support. And so I started working for Hammond Kroll in New York City. Hammond's brother, Boris, has run a fairly large company that deals in fabrics for interiors. At that time, he was a young man who was just coming into business. But Hammond,
K-R-O-L-L.
Right. Hammond did furniture design. I'm groping for the word for people just individually. He would do custom furniture design, but he also, in his shops, built the furniture and completely designed an interior, say, for well-to-do people for their apartment. And as such, I got quite a bit of practice at designing furniture. I was called a junior furniture designer. I was also the office boy, and I had to, for example, get on the subway and go over to Brooklyn and pick up some cushions that some Russian lady may have sewn up just so for one of his clients. But I did a lot of that, and it gave me a good insight into how things are done like that. That was from 1934 to 1935.
Was Mr. Kroll a modern furniture designer? Was he a visionary like
very much so.
Like
he definitely did not do classical furniture. It was modern, but it had its own touch. It would be very colorful. Some of his things may tend to have swoopy lines. He was dealing with exotic plastics for lamps and things like that. We really did a complete job in the shops.
It wasn't Art Deco then, I think.
Well, it might have been. It came from there. but it was more modern, and it was very expensive. I next went to work for Bernard McFadden, who published 5 or 6 magazines in New York.
MC.
That is Bernard, B-E-R-N-A-R-R, McFadden, capital M-A-C, capital F-A-D-D-E-N. Bernard published Liberty Magazine, which was the, I think, third after the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's. He published, was it Physical Education? This was his big thing originally. He's the man who, I think, when he was 76, parachuted into the Hudson River. He was athletic little fella. He published True Detective and True Story and that type of thing. We were on 42nd Street. We started up in 68th Street in Broadway, but we ended up near the Chrysler Building on 42nd Street. And he had 3 floors there of offices. And 1 complete floor of photographic studios. The magazines he published relied on photographic black and white illustrations. This really had nothing to do with transportation, but I learned, I was rated as a cartoonist. And actually I had to prepare my own copy, my own ads, and I would do this for all sorts of small divisions all around his company. He had more offices, I believe, in the Chrysler Building. And it gave me a good knowledge of how photography is used and the advertising part of the game, plus printing and lettering.
Mr. McFadden was a dynamic, charismatic character, at least so it would seem from his career and his photograph. Did you meet him?
I did several times. Again, this may not have anything to do with transportation, but he had a resort, I believe it was named Deauville, further upstate in New York, and he used to have a marathon run once a year from New York City, 42nd Street, on up there. People would either walk fast or jog, and every night they would be put up, and they had trucks following them with food and beverages. And when he'd start, when that would start, 2 years in a row, I had to take photographs. Okay. I would be taking photographs or directing a photographer to take pictures of Bernard and Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia at the weighing-in ceremonies. Every one of these people were weighed, and we had some quite spectacular people coming around there. We'd stand there in front of the scales and take all their pictures. But when Fiorello came on, he's a very short person, and I'd have to get him to take his big cowboy hat off because the camera couldn't see his face, and he wanted that hat on. It was part of his makeup, and of course Bernard, which never wore a hat, he had his hair standing on end. I think that was part of his story, that he went started to go bald at one time and kept pulling his hair up, and his hair came back out. But anyway, I worked for that company for 3 years, I believe.
At this time, McFadden was a thorough physical fitness devotee.
Oh yes, yeah. I might say
physical culture. I think it was
physical culture.
Right.
Yeah. He published several magazines on that subject, but he started out sort of starving along as a minor publisher for quite a while. I don't know whether this should be left in or not, but he had several office managers of different, one was over more than another one was over, and these were quite large ladies who had been with him from an early time. I believe he liked big ladies, but we used to notice that. They must have had some personal friendship. Well, anyway, I perhaps that should be taken out. I don't know. Let's see now.
In your career with McFadden Publications, you did acquire a feeling for working with photographs. Layout, magazine layout, and captioning.
I was strictly in the circulation part of it, advertising.
I see. Okay. Working with advertisers, preparing their tear sheets and so forth.
Yeah, and of course I was doing a lot of the artwork. This was a minor position.
Mm-hmm.
I was still going to night school, and I felt I was lucky to have employment. I needed it.
As an aside, did you ever meet Fulton Ousler at the McFadden Publications, who was the editor of Liberty, as I recall?
Yeah, I had seen him several times and attended a small lecture one day. It seemed that somebody had gotten an inside track on what horse to pick at a track. And definitely skullduggery was going on, and a lot of us were placing bets. I only took a half a bet out with an office companion. That was not my thing. But he finally learned this, and that I think also it was coming through his office unbeknownst to him. And he got quite put out about it and definitely forbade anybody in the company to continue placing these bets, however they were placed. That was my only experience with Fulton Ousler. While I was at McFadden's, I started making illustrations of automobiles, definitely to get a job as an automotive stylist. And I had the theory then that I could not sleep as much as most people had to, because I needed the extra time. I was working and I was going to night school, and I had a room near Pratt in Brooklyn. I would go home from work, that is, I'd go to the room, and I'd sleep for 3 hours, and then I'd get up and work for 3 or 4 hours on my renderings that I was going to send to General Motors. And
How did you happen to pick General Motors?
Well, somebody said that was the best place to start. And then I'd have 3 more hours of sleep and get up and get in the subway and go over to Manhattan and go to work.
Did you check with Mr. Professor Boudreau on this particular career?
No. By this time, I was getting along pretty well with one of the, I'll call him a name designer in the New York area. I can't think of his name now. It wasn't Dreyfus. I may come up with it later.
That would be interesting to know.
Yeah. He was a successful industrial designer in the New York area. I think about the, I'd say about the fourth in importance. But he was teaching at night at Pratt. And one of the reasons for Pratt's success then with kids like me was that they demanded that their instructors be in the trade. And in other words, we got first-hand information. I wish I could think of his name, but actually, I don't think he was too influential with me.
Was he on the order of Dreyfus, the importance of Dreyfus?
Yeah, right. At any rate, I made some samples, we call them sample renderings, and sent them out to General Motors, and got a letter back saying come to work in September that year. That was 1937.
You sent them blind, or did you send them to the...
I sent them to... I had learned the name of the man to send them to. He was not a designer. He was in the... I think he was the assistant... what do they call a man who manages things?
Maybe administrative assistant.
Administrative assistant to Harley Earl out there. At the moment, I can't think of his name. I'm sorry. But someone who's worked at General Motors in styling back in that area would know it.
Howard?
Keep going.
I can't come up with anything.
Yeah, that's the man.
Howard Springer or something like that? Mm,
yeah, and that's not the right name, but I think it was Howard, mm-hmm. first name. At any rate, I went to work in the Cadillac studio, and
this was your first assignment?
That was my first assignment, and I succeeded in finally having a hubcap design accepted. This is a start.
Now you were an apprentice designer, and where did you work?
We worked in the behind the General Motors building.
In the New Center area?
In the New Center area.
Mm-hmm.
Styling was on three floors near the top of that building, the top floor being mostly a showroom.
The Fisher Building? Or was it the New Center?
No, it was not the Fisher Building. It was on the street immediately behind, that is south of the General Motors Building, which
is the New Center Building?
Yeah. No. I don't think it had a name.
Oh, okay.
It had an address.
All right.
As a matter of fact, it had a tunnel running under Milwaukee, I think was the name of the street.
Mm-hmm.
The tunnel went to the basement of the General Motors Building, where they had restaurants and cafeterias.
Who was heading up the?
Harley Earl was head man. The Cadillac studio was headed up by a young man whose name was Bill Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
who later on succeeded Harley
mm-hmm.
as the...
Is he the one who hired you? Or he was your first...
he was my first boss.
Boss.
Yeah. I learned quite a bit there. I found a young man, another young man, Roy A. Brown, who you may have talked to
mm-hmm.
already.
Mm-hmm.
Roy and I became friends there, and I remember we were both quite impressed with a LaSalle model that was suddenly wheeled into the Cadillac studio. It seemed that the LaSalle car was being shut down, and I don't know what they did with the people, the personnel in that studio, but they closed it down, opened some adjoining doors, and wheeled in a LaSalle model, which I had not seen. This later had an influence on some designs that Roy and I worked on. It had a very tall, narrow radiator grill in the front. I think they made a sort of a junior Cadillac out of it. They just, you know, used the Cadillac name.
Well, LaSalle had been about 10 years old by then.
I think so.
Yes.
I'm not sure. But as I say, it had an influence on both of us. I liked it tremendously, and that was my first view of it, just being pushed into the studio.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the truck studio for a while.
Excuse me, was General Motors phasing out the LaSalle design department?
I believe they were.
Uh-huh.
I believe they were phasing out the name, but I'm not sure.
1938?
Be 1938.
They were about to drop the LaSalle from the Cadillac line.
I believe they were,
mm-hmm.
but I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so many years later, I don't recall. At any rate, I worked in the truck studio for a while. Roy and I were the, not the only ones, but we were the chief ones who could do airbrush work.
Mm-hmm. Have you learned that at Pratt?
I had starved myself and bought my first airbrush when I was going to Pratt. I was not encouraged by anybody at Pratt. I just wanted to do it.
Can you explain why it's called an airbrush, very briefly?
Well, it works like a paint gun. It uses air pressure to atomize paint mixed with water.
Mm-hmm.
It blows it out onto the surface you're painting, and therefore it's called an airbrush. I had taught myself how to use that. In fact, I had an illustration here. That's the first one I ever did with air. It's starting to go moldy. But
1935.
Yeah, I dug that out years ago, or from years ago. It looks like things are happening to it, but
very good.
I remember I used Dr. Martin's special paints, and they seem to have held up for
very well
all
yes.
the way.
Very well.
But I could do airbrush, and Roy could, and other people were picking it up, and we started doing full-size airbrush illustrations.
Full-size being?
Well, we'd have a side view and a front view. And as a matter of fact, Roy was doing this before I was, but...
Poster size, or...?
Well, no, the bigger than that, really.
Okay, almost the size of what...
The company would buy rolls of black paper. The rolls were 8 feet wide, mm-hmm. and they were big rolls, such as you see going into a newspaper printing plant. And we would tack this up on what we call a blackboard. Have you had this described before?
No.
Oh, well, this is pretty common in the industry. A blackboard is usually 8 feet high and 24 feet long. And it will have a framework of 2x4s, and it will have plywood nailed to the framework on each side, and the plywood will be painted black, and the whole gadget will be mounted with triangular legs that stick out to balance it on casters, usually locking type casters. And I'll say in the old days, that is back in 1937, we, using big French curves we call sweeps, we would draw cars on there. Cars that would be drawn over the basic package designated by the engineers. That is, so they would have headroom clearance and clear the engine and radiator and
you would have
so forth.
The dimensional package in front of you?
Yeah, we would know what the dimensions were.
I see.
And we would... We would draw these cars. Quite often the studio draftsman would do this with white or silver pencil, and the artist would finish it up, that is, put the lines in that he'd like to get in, or see to it that the draftsman got the lines just so. And these draftsmen were very skillful people with lines and surfaces, of course. And then the artist would render this using colored paint that would show up against the black. Mm-hmm. And he'd also use black to make the blacks more solid. But we'd get the highlights in and, you know, some reflections. So that a viewer, perhaps a group of executives, could visualize what we had in mind. Usually these full-size renderings would be chosen from many smaller renderings, which would be in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, we mostly worked on black paper because it was a quick way of showing form. We didn't have to put a lot of color in.
And this is still being done in the industry, as far as you know?
Far as I know,
mm-hmm.
with some differences.
Yes.
But
it was the basic beginning of the design configuration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we did that at Chrysler, and we did that at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, far as I'm concerned, it's universally used. At any rate...
Was there a special black paper that you used?
Yes.
What was it called?
I don't remember the name of the paper. It wasn't too expensive a paper.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do too much with it, but...
Did it have a special surface or luminosity or...?
No, it was just black.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably put out by one company, and probably all the automotive companies bought from the same source, because I don't think there was much reason for selling that in the market elsewhere. The smaller sheets of paper that we sat at our desks and made our own perspective illustrations, which we called renderings, they were made by Mitiantes. I don't remember how to spell that, but we call it Mitiantes.
Mm-hmm.
And it not only came in black, but it came in other colors. And we commonly used a dark brown,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a dark green or blue, but mostly black. And I might say in those days that we took these home with us, and we worked at home, not being paid, and brought them in merely to show what we could do and enhance our career, so to speak. We also work quite a bit of overtime. And again, I don't know if this is part of the transportation story, but we were we were given dinner for working overtime, but we were limited as to how much we could buy, including no desserts. And we'd after normal working hours, we'd have to hustle over to the coffee shop in the basement of the General Motors building and get our meal and hustle back and go to work. And one night I was late and I was running through this tunnel and I knocked over, who was the great inventor for General Motors?
Kettering?
Kettering.
Boss Kettering.
Boss Kettering. The tunnel under Milwaukee was actually, it had a giant steam pipe running through the thing and it took a couple of corners. And you had to sort of keep over to one side so you're away from this this pipe, which was sheltered in some areas. And I was running through there and I cut a corner. And I remember I was leaning into the corner very much. I might say I had been playing pro football just up until almost that time.
With whom?
With a small team out in Long Island. There was a league there. We sometimes tried out players for a year who were heading for Fordham University and some of the bigger colleges. Their coaches would want them to have a year of seasoning. And we also supplied players to the bigger pro teams when they would run out of somebody. We sometimes had ringers. It's a pretty tough league. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was banked way over for my turn. And my shoulder went right into the stomach of this very tall man, and I knocked him right over. I picked him up, dusted him off, and just kept on running. And later on, I went to get in an elevator to go up to work. I think it was the next day. And I suddenly realized, I saw Kettering is on the same elevator. I suddenly realized who it was that I had knocked over. And I don't think he knew who I was. I'm glad he didn't. At least he didn't bat an eye, but I really hit him. I guess that's a story of transportation, because he got transported a couple of feet that he didn't expect.
Broken field running through the General Motors tunnel.
Yeah. Anyway, General Motors laid off, and as one of the newcomers, I was laid off in 1938.
How about Roy Brown?
Roy stayed.
He did.
Yeah. I'm not aware now what happened to Roy. He'd have to tell you himself.
Did you did you get to meet Bill Mitchell at all?
Oh yeah, I worked for Bill Mitchell.
Tell us a bit about Bill. Your impressions of Bill Mitchell in those days.
I was quite impressed. Bill, I think, was 24. I could be wrong.
How long had he been with General Motors?
I think probably 2, maybe 3 years. Mm-hmm. But he was a very impressionable person, and I was amazed that a person that young would be so successful. And he told me how old he was to point out to me that I could go places too. He was very mature for his age. He had a rather deep voice. He used it to good effect. He sounded very, very confident. He was slim. He had very blonde hair, a rather ruddy complexion that goes with that blonde hair, and was I thought quite a guy. Very smooth, very, very smooth fellow. I never actually saw him lay pencil to paper as a designer, but I believe that's how he was probably good at it, because that's how he got there.
In 3 years, he had become head of the Cadillac Design Studio.
Yeah. I don't know whether it was 3 years, because obviously I wasn't there when he when he started. But I think I read someplace where he had impressed Harley Earl quite a bit and come up quite fast. Mm-hmm.
When you left, when you had to leave, did he encourage you to continue and not get discouraged?
I had moved up into the truck studio.
Oh, I see.
And I really wasn't in too much contact with him when I left.
Was that the GM?
When you left General Motors, you left very suddenly. I guess it's part of the story, so I'll go ahead with it.
Yes.
But at one point in the Cadillac studio, we had suddenly, just before quitting time, we were told to turn all our pencils in. any material we had. Mm-hmm. There was, in other words, there was a shakedown.
Just pencils.
Well, pencils or even little stubs,
okay. Mm-hmm.
Anything like that. And then one by one, men were called out of the studio. They were being called up to the administrative offices. Are you running out of tape?
Oh, okay.
And we didn't see them again. Mm-hmm. That's the way it went. And I got my call, and I was being notified to go to the truck studio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, evidently, they didn't want to spend money on the Cadillac designing because it had been done for that year, something like that. And so I ended up in the truck studio. And then sometime later, I got another call, it was many months later, and I suddenly found myself out on Milwaukee Street in the cold, I think it was March, with Johnny Chica. I don't know if you've come across him yet.
How do you spell that?
Either CKA or KA. He's a fairly well-known man amongst Detroit automotive designers today. And he and I were counting how much money we had in our pockets, you know.
You were separated without any warning, really.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Things were done in a cold manner then.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of the story. I went back to New York, and I don't have it down on my record here, but I worked for a short time for...
also one in England, but that magazine, I think, was the automotive magazine of its day. It was something like Aerial Digest was for aircraft. It had a lot of advertisements in it for automobiles and automotive things. It had articles describing automobiles, articles on engines, and so forth. It was the premier automotive magazine then.
Are you having trouble with it? Okay. I didn't really succeed with this job. It wasn't my my type of thing, but the art editor liked my ability to illustrate automotive things, and I did get some freelance work from him for the next couple of years, illustrating engines in so-called pen and ink, black and white, you know, with a lot of detail and so forth. So. It was a handy thing, and it kept me in touch with the automotive industry. I can't remember now how or why I contacted Norman Bel Geddes, but I was looking for a job. And
what year was this?
This would have been in 1938. I went around there, showed them some of my designs and illustrations and so forth, got an encouraging reply, and went to work for him a little later. He, at that time, was enlarging his staff a little bit because he had succeeded in getting a contract with General Motors to do their exhibit at the New York World's Fair. And he had a lot in front of him at the time. I think I was the only person on his staff who was what I would call an idea man, a designer who could illustrate his ideas and go in that direction. The rest of the people were fairly technical. Some of them in the architectural field. At any rate, a lot went across my desk. When you might call me a utility man.
Mm-hmm.
I was still a young man then, of course. But I got the job, and I was telling my father about it, and he said, "Why did you know that?" And he told me the story that I told you earlier on this tape. And he wrote a letter to Norman, reminding him of this. And Norman called me down, you know, a week or two after he had hired me. And I thought, uh-oh, what's coming now? And he read me this letter, and he said, "That's right." He said, "Your dad gave me my first job." So.
How long did he stay with your father? Did you ever
know? I don't remember. I doubt it would have been very long, because, as I say. My dad went back to New York. I had an illustration of this later. He did come out to the Detroit area many years later, and he was taken on as the as an art editor for Jam Handy. Mm-hmm. And my stepmother came out with him and picked up some work. As I say, she was in fashions, and they couldn't stand it in Detroit. I don't think they stayed 6 months. They went back to New York. Just typical of, you know, a New Yorker. And I remember when I was a young man, I was that way too. To me, Detroit was sort of a way stop on the way out to Hollywood, you know, and I don't mean I was going to go to Hollywood, but a New Yorker thinks of, there's only a few spots on the other side of the Hudson River, and they all run together.
Like the Saul Steinberg cover.
Exactly. I thought that was a beautiful illustration of what I'm talking about. But at any rate, Norman acknowledged that that's where he got started. I worked for Norman mostly on the New York World's Fair, the General Motors exhibit called the Futurama, and my big job there was to do architecturally integrated lettering for this huge display. It had a lot of formed concrete shapes, and Norman wanted lettering that would be really integrated with it. I have some examples there of that type of thing. The first thing he wanted me to do was to originate an alphabet of lettering. He wanted it to be very different, and he gave me a desk up on the top floor right next to Al Fordyce, who was a very influential person in my career. Al was the chief architect for this whole thing.
He was a Bill Getty's employee?
Yes. I'm sure he made many more bucks per week than I did. Al was a Yale graduate. He belonged to the Yale club. And every once in a while, he'd throw things down, you know, on his desk and say, "Gil, let's go to the club and get a drink," you know, and would go off. He helped me a lot. He was he had a real good voice, a real ho-ho guy. Tell you more about him later. It was a good thing I was right next to him, because I was doing lettering in some instances. The letters were 20 or 30 feet high, and I would have to make giant scale sketches of them and put them on the wall and stand back and get people to come in and criticize them with me, and then I'd have to go ahead and make drawings like a draftsman would. Some of these letters had catwalks inside of them. They're big.
This was for the Bell Geddes Futurama display?
Yeah, for the General Motors Futurama. The futuristic alphabet didn't work. I found that if I went too far away from what we recognize as a letter, why, people wouldn't recognize it. In other words, an A wouldn't look like an A. This is a very difficult field.
The perspective would change?
Well, it's simply because if you make a letter it's too unusual, it won't be recognized as being that letter. But this took several weeks to discover, and it wasn't exactly pleasant. Norman was a very very hard taskmaster. He wanted perfection, and it was difficult for him to visualize my problem. He evidently could visualize all sorts of alphabets, and I could too. But when you put them down on paper and you show them to other people, they might not know what they were. And these things had three dimensions to them too. I was given another task, and I'll have to explain something about the display. Did I explain already that, yeah, I think I did, that people rode around inside this display, looking over this giant scale model of the eastern United States. And when they stepped out, they found themselves in the same intersection in a city that they'd been looking at.
This time a full-size intersection.
Yeah, that's right, full-size intersection. Well, we had four buildings, one covering each corner. At the end, the streets had to end at the ends of those buildings, and they ended with a concrete wall that was, I think three of them were 64 feet high, and I think the other one was higher, 84 feet, something like that. Huge. And you, when you stepped out, you were on these elevated sidewalks. The idea was that there'd be more room for the vehicular traffic down below if there were no sidewalks, and that cars could scoot directly into parking places underneath the buildings, which was part of Norman's story. And of course, as a pedestrian, you didn't have to worry about being run down crossing the street, because we had four bridges going around the intersection. Well, one problem that hadn't occurred to anyone was what to put on the walls at the ends of the streets. There were just these big, bare concrete walls. And by the way, we had a scale model of the whole thing, which was, some 10 feet square, I guess. I can't remember the scale, whether it was quarter inch to the foot or what. But when the scale model was completed, it had suddenly occurred to somebody that these concrete walls might not look very glamorous. So Norman said, "Gil, come up with something to put on those walls." Well, I worked for weeks on it. I tried to maybe illustrate in three dimensions, in bas relief on the walls, what the whole thing was all about. And I tried to explain it with lettering, too, you know, with words. And he wanted me to use the new alphabet, which I really hadn't come up with yet. You know, we were trying all different things, and it just didn't work at all. You couldn't do it. But I, in disgust one day, next to Al Fordyce, I whacked my pencil down. It was probably getting on to lunchtime, and I said, "Well, as far as I'm concerned, they could use mirrors." And Al said, "What did you say?" And I said, "Use mirrors. My God, you know, that would be it." Well, we took the scale model, and we had mirrors made, put at each end of each street, and it was difficult in those days to bore holes in glass, but we had a model maker who could bore holes in glass. We bored some little peepholes through these mirrors, and we looked through these peepholes, and it looked like a futuristic Fifth Avenue going on forever down there. I mean, we had little people in the sidewalks, and we had little streamlined vehicles in the streets, and also crossing. And you'd look through this peephole, and you'd see reflection after reflection, and it just looked like this avenue went on to the far distance, and you could see traffic crossing it in the distance, and it was marvelous. And it was strictly a remark. Norman said, "Gil, I'll double your salary and buy you a new suit of clothes if they'll accept it." And they had a bunch of GM executives come down from Detroit and look through the peepholes, and they all fell in love with it. You know, it was just terrific. And they, Norman had a 10% plus contract with GM. And they all, they voted him, I forget how much more money, to put the mirrors up. Well, the subcontractor who was building the thing, and it was already underway, being built full size over in the Meadows, started playing with it. He wanted more money. We found we could only get pieces of mirror that were 8 feet, either 4 feet by 8 feet or 8 feet by 8 feet. And these mirrors had to be placed on these walls 200 feet from each other. They had to line up with a mirror directly opposite them 200 feet away, and they also had to line up flat with the adjacent mirrors. And I can see today this would be quite a problem for somebody to put up. But they played with the idea. The price kept going up and up, and the time when they could finish it kept going further out in the future, and they finally didn't do anything. And I didn't get my suit of clothes, and I didn't get my doubled salary. But Oh, another thing happened with that display. We designed automobiles and buses, things like that, of the future,
mm-hmm.
all very nicely streamlined in a Bel Geddes way. The buses, I remember, were double-deckers, but they were teardrop-shaped nevertheless. They had lots of little windows like airplanes in them. And we were going to do those, too. We were going to have a subcontractor make dummy ones. And I thought, oh, boy, here I can... Here I get a chance to design some real future cars, and maybe somebody back in General Motors will notice for a change. The dealer organization stepped in and said, nothing doing. We want to show the cars we're going to sell. So any pictures you see of that display, I think I have some here. They have the, they have the old, you know, those contemporary cars, which to me are very old.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And not only that, they're not arranged to look as if they're in traffic. They're just placed down there as if they were in a showroom. But the dealer organization demanded the right to determine what was going to go in there. And that's what happened to all our good ideas. But we did make scale models of these things that ran around the scale countryside. Do you want to quit for a minute? He knew that, Norman knew that I had been into printing, ordering print when I was with McFadden, and, you know, that I had had earlier experience. And I didn't realize it, but he had a hobby. It was printing. And we moved from this old brownstone off of Park Avenue about 37th Street to... new quarters I can't remember the name of it, in Rockefeller Plaza. They had built a new building there, the Associated Press building, and we moved in there, and I had to prepare this pamphlet for Norman, which he sent out to everybody that counted, announcing he was moving and what he had done. Actually, this is the second one. I haven't got the first one.
This is sort of a brochure that he was on for prospective clients.
Yeah, right. And present clients. In our new office, we had a big printing press. Actually, it was a reconditioned press. It had a flywheel about 5 or 6 feet in diameter. It was the old Platin type, where the rollers came up over the platen, picked up ink, and went back and rolled it over the type. And Norman, it seems, had a very strong hobby here. He would insist on going over everything that I had prepared, and since the press wasn't used steadily, I would have to go over to Jersey City and hire an itinerant press. What would they call them? They set up the type.
Linotyper?
No, that wasn't exactly the word, but a man who could set the type up and lock it into place.
Yes.
And picking people up like this who weren't steadily employed, I found usually they were alcoholic. They were, getting what work they could. And this led to some trouble every once in a while, particularly because Norman would, even when I would print a contract, which involves very small type, he would criticize it for its spacing. He'd want an extra M put in, and M is a term for the smallest spacer
mm-hmm.
you can get. He'd want an extra M put in between a couple of letters.
E-M.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And I tended to get sloppy work out of these people. And it really wasn't my full-time job anyway.
Itinerant typesetters.
Yeah, typesetter. Mm-hmm. That's the word. I don't know if these people exist anymore. But he also put me...
You're in a lost art, I'm afraid.
Yeah. He also put me in charge of his filing department, where he had all his old models and drawings and a lot of literature and so forth. As I say, I was the sort of odd man, the utilitarian fellow. But...
Why not interrupt here
go
for
ahead.
A moment, Gil? And would you, for the benefit of our...
Listeners,
very quickly run over Mr. Bel Geddes' accomplishments from 1928 on.
Well, now there's a paragraph.
Don't read the whole paragraph, but just a quick sentence.
Okay. Okay, this is titled Norman Bel Geddes, The Last 12 Years.
That's published in 39.
Right.
Or 38.
Right. 1928, Simmons Beds.
He apparently did a design for Simmons Beds. Right?
Yeah, he didn't want to try and make steel furniture look like wood furniture and produce very simple designs, it says here. Okay. Another one was 1929, Franklin Simon and Company Window Displays. First merchandising displays in modern style in America. System interchangeable units was used. And I might say that it seems to me when he came out with some of these designs, which I think were on Fifth Avenue, they had to have police to control some of the mobs that were looking at them. I remember that. 1930, I may pronounce this wrong, Lysistrata?
Lysistrata.
A modern adaptation of Aristophanes' famous comedy written 2,000 years ago. Well, Norman was famous for his stage designs. And I might say that...
This was one of his more exciting ones.
Yeah, and I think he was getting into the financial backing here. And incidentally, he had a financial backer himself, of course. But,
and who was that?
I don't recall. Some banker.
Otto Kahn, I think.
I think it sounds real familiar. It probably K-A-H-N. Was.
Yeah,
that's right. Very well-known person.
Patron of the arts, I think.
Yes. I might say that when Norman did a stage design, amongst people like myself, he was kind of famous for what we call the Geddes slot. He would have a huge slot that people would come out of at the back of the stage, and lighting and smoke might come out of there, and lighting would change on it. He was terrific with color. And I used the Geddes slot for the entranceway to the GM Futurama display.
Mm-hmm.
People went up these ramps, this crowd of people, and they entered it going through this slot, which was painted a bright red inside in contrast to the white wall that was, I think, some
How
70
wide
or 80
was that
feet.
Slot on the Futurama?
Well, it was wide enough to take
four people
six
abreast.
Or eight, yeah, maybe six, maybe six, more people abreast.
Six,
I don't recall,
abreast.
But it was quite a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was some 72 feet or something.
And
up
you,
here.
You cribbed that from Bel Geddes's.
Yeah, and naturally he bought the idea. As a matter of fact, Al Fordyce and I had to come up with the idea for how to get people in here. What are we going to do for an entrance?
Mm-hmm.
I simply, as you say, I cribbed it from. But getting back to this list, 1931, Philco radios, first mass production radio that was a usable piece of furniture. 1932, Horizons, a book, treating the broad subject of design as affecting Getty's own work up to this date, and it contained prognostications.
This was rather an influential book at the time, was it not?
Yes, yes it was.
You had mentioned that you had read it.
Yeah, it was, and it I think it foretold his book of the future, Horizons, Highways and Horizons. In other words, he cribbed from his own book there with his next title. 1933, Standard Gas Equipment Stoves, the first all-sheet steel stove welded to a tubing frame, all white, all rounded corners, no projections. I'm reading this... because it's important.
Yes.
Sitting flush with the floor, the necessity of cleaning underneath was eliminated. Although a radical departure when it appeared, the style has been followed by other manufacturers, and I might say right down to today. He's the guy that started that.
That was his original design.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His original conception.
Conception, right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of having something like that. Pan American Airway Interiors. This is 1934. The China Clippers were the first airplanes with comfortable berths, so forth and so on. I forgot to say that I had something to do with that independent of Norman. I had worked for a man, I can't remember his name, his first name was Howard Ketchum or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was first color expert in New York, set up a fancy office on 42nd Street, and I would go in and freelance work for him, and we did colored fabrics and things for these China Clippers. Now, we were not designing the shapes of the seats and so forth.
Merely the fabric.
But apparently Norman was. But we were, Howard's idea was that certain colors should be avoided in aircraft and certain colors should be used.
and we used blues, different shades of blues in those clippers. His theory was that if you use browns and yellows, you might get airsick, which was a problem in those days. And I think there was some truth to it. But yes. What would you call him? A color psychiatrist or something mm-hmm. like that. Right. But he had a big clientele and charged a lot of money. But people like me did the work. People like myself.
K-E-T-C-H-A-N.
Yeah, I think that was his name, but it wasn't a thing that I did a lot, or I didn't stick with him. It was, as I say, it was strictly what we call freelancing.
He was a pioneer in that industry, was he not?
Yeah, he was, definitely, very definitely.
Psychological effect of color.
Yeah, he made a big business out of it. I'm gonna veer off the pamphlet here a little bit and say that one of the things years later I had to do for Norman on this General Motors Futurama was come up with a way of getting a contractor to give us the correct color inside the theater that was the interior of one of these buildings on this intersection. We started at the floor with a yellow, and we went up these walls, and they were very big walls, with grading the yellow to white. In other words, when it got to the ceiling, it was white. And it had a cove, that is, the wall simply turned on a radius and became the ceiling. And Norman hired a color expert, somebody else outside our outfit. And this woman came in, she's very well qualified and everything, but she could not do anything to make sure the contrast, she could pick colors out, but she couldn't do anything to convey to the contractor how to get the right color diffusing going up these walls to the ceiling. And it ended up with me doing it. And I guess Norman didn't know I had worked for Ketchum before. Mm-hmm. But what I did is we had a steel draftsman working for us. He laid out all the steel structure that went inside of all this. He was not an artist by any means, but we got him to lay out this wall on a giant piece of illustration board. You can buy illustration board in the bigger sheets that it originally is pressed into, and he laid this out in with a hard pencil, and then I took I laid out strips across these walls that were 3 feet high in scale, just, I don't know, 2 inches high or something like that on this drawing, I can't remember. But then I had to paint each one a different gradation of yellow. This is very difficult. Yellow is any color is difficult to do that with, but I had to do that repeatedly, go over it and over it and over it again. I worked nights on that thing and sweated on it, and under artificial light the yellow looks different. And I had to get the full piece of illustration board done right. I had to get it approved by Norman, and then we had to cut it in slices. We had to give the paint contractor one, we had to protect it, we had to keep one in the office, we had to give the contractor for whom the paint contractor worked for another copy, we had to send one to GM. So each one of these stripes had to be consistent its full length. I got the whole thing done very carefully, and then we found out the structural steel man didn't think this was much of a job for him, so he didn't pay much attention to what he was doing, and he was 10 feet off on the height of the thing. Had to do it all over again. But those are some of the problems you meet with in design. Okay, I'll go back to the brochure if you'd like me to.
The Belgetti's brochure.
Yeah, the Belgetti's brochure. 1935, Soconi Vacuum Oil Company. A thorough research into the subject resulted in recommendations placed before officials and directors by means of 24 graphic charts. I don't think this is interesting. 1936, Dead End, the outstanding theatrical success of this season. He did the stage for that.
He did a very interesting set there, as I recall. It shows the east side penthouses in the distance, or the near distance, and the slum pier area that
right.
that the Dead End kids swam off of it.
Right.
In the near full foreground, yes. That was carried over to the movie, too.
Yes, it was. Next is 1937, the Shell Oil advertising campaign through the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, supplying ideas, copy, and illustrations for their current stop-and-go series. I won't go on with that one.
Yeah.
1938, the Barbary Restaurant. I got to work on this one.
Did you?
This small room, 20 feet wide, is an eating and drinking place accommodating 64 persons in comfortable chairs and so forth. I didn't have much to do with it, but I thought it was an outstanding place. Then 1930...
He did the interior decor of the...
Yeah, and he designed the...
The seating.
The seats and so forth.
The bar seats and...
Yeah.
It
was a very...
futuristic.
Very, yeah, a very stylish place.
Very
it was... I never ate there because it was very costly.
Barberry.
Right.
And that was in Manhattan, I think.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then we have the General Motors New York World's Fair.
Well, he had quite a career.
Yeah.
The last 10 years. He was pretty much the hottest industrial designer available at that time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, very much in demand.
I wanted to say that having to do with transportation, I don't see it on this folder. I finished with it, incidentally. Norman designed the smooth, clean type of gasoline station.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what company it is. I know I have it in amongst the...
It wasn't Saucony Vacuum or Shell, either of those.
I'm not going to say now because I really don't know. No, it's not in this folder. I think that's one of his.
Doodling.
Let me keep looking, if you don't mind.
Because it has pertinence.
It has pertinence for the transportation story,
mm-hmm.
Since we use...